Increase Lapham came to Wisconsin to build a canal, but he became the state's first scientist. Lapham's curiosity led him to investigate everything from trees to Indian mounds to the weather. Biographers Paul Hayes and Martha Berglund tell us about the life of this Wisconsin legend.
Increase Allen Lapham was 25 when he got to Milwaukee, and within days, he was walking the woods and walking the beach, taking measurements, taking temperature of the river, doing everything that that his curiosity led him into.
He had been doing these same observations, gathering the same data for since he was a young teenager. His first article about his observations was written when he was 16. The editor wasn't aware at the time that he was publishing a 16-year-old boy. He had almost no formal education, and that was a great sorrow of his. But as soon as he was able to work, he had to work because the family was a large one and they needed money, and he was able to earn money young as 13 on the Erie Canal.
It was canal work that brought him here, and for the first time in his life, he had arrived at the actual frontier of settlement. He's a curious man who's interested in every aspect of nature, and Wisconsin is an unexplored, undescribed blank tablet. And if anybody in the East, any botanist, any geologist, wants to know about the plants and the rocks here, they have to write to Lapham. And he develops a wide-ranging correspondence with the then greatest scientists in the country, not only in the United States, but also in Europe.
So he knew he was their eyes and ears on the frontier, and they were very excited that they were going to have this good observer. And he was very generous with his time and energy and sent many specimens, many letters, many descriptions to the East, to the South. He was sort of the point man for science in Wisconsin territory.
So the question comes up, why was he forgotten? He left behind so much material that it's hard to get your hands around it. The science he was working in at the time was cutting-edge science, brand new ideas that he was bringing to the frontier. He would do lectures that were just astonishingly modern for the time. But since then, in the century and a half since he died, the science he worked in has become settled science. It's the science you learn when you're in the primary grades.
So the star scientists became more and more the specialists. And Increase was a generalist on the frontier, and his kind of science was being replaced. One of the main reasons to me that Lapham is important is that he was, in some ways, a model citizen. He was honest, he was amazingly thorough in whatever he set out to do, and he said that in order to build a good society, we had to build it on a knowledge of where we had come from.
Martha Berglund and Paul Hayes are the authors of Studying Wisconsin, The Life of Increase Lapham. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Increase Lapham also had a role in the founding of the Wisconsin State Herbarium, and last month, staff at the herbarium discovered century-old fungal specimens that had been collected by the famous scientist and educator George Washington Carver.
And we're joined now by Ken Cameron, who is a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
Well, what can you tell us about this historic discovery?
Yeah, it was really a surprise to us. We have a very large collection of fungi, approximately 120,000 specimens. And when most people think of fungi, they're thinking of mushrooms. But these are not mushrooms. They're microfungi, or we sometimes call them parasitic fungi. They are the rusts and smuts and other nasty things like mildews that affect crop plants in particular. So we were funded by the National Science Foundation to digitize, in other words, to database our entire collection of these very important fungi. And we had no idea that George Washington Carver was even interested in them. Most people think of George Washington Carver and his famous work with peanuts. Mm-hmm. But in the process of databasing our collection, we came upon 25 specimens that were collected by the man himself.
And these, just to stick with the microfungi a bit, these are a big deal in agriculture. You mentioned something, it was something like this that caused the great potato famine in Ireland, right? That was in this category?
Yes, exactly. And so many other crop plants. I mean, any of the farmers who are listening or people who have a home vegetable garden will recognize things like powdery mildew and blights. In the old days, white pine blister rust was a very important, devastating disease of the white pine timber industry. So these are potentially catastrophic fungi that cause diseases. Not all of them. Some of them are you know, benign. But in the early days of the university's founding, with our agricultural history, documenting these pathogenic or disease-causing fungi was very important to the early scientists.
And how did these specimens end up in Wisconsin?
So, to my understanding, I'm not a scholar of George Washington Carver, but I can tell you that he was the first African American student at what became Iowa State University, and his mentor studied fungi and these microfungi in particular. So he obviously received his training. He was then recruited to the Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, where he continued his scientific study and collecting of these fungi in young North America. Many of the species were new to science. And as he collected these, he distributed them to different major universities around the country. And the University of Wisconsin in Madison was a young, growing powerhouse of research in the Midwest at the turn of the early 20th century. And so undoubtedly they came here in that way.
When I think of an archive of text material, I think, oh, there's books and maybe diaries and documents and things like that. What does a microfungus archive look like? What form
does it
take?
Well, it's certainly not very glamorous. if I were to show you these specimens, you'd probably give me a strange look. People who collect them are actually collecting little black spots or white powdery residues on the surfaces of plant leaves. So remember that these are the diseases of the plant. So we, in the specimen, not only get the fungus, but we get the host plant. And these are dried and they're packaged in envelopes with a label on the outside. So the specimen itself may not look all that attractive, but the history that is held within these is truly phenomenal.
Yeah, what stood out to you as you took a gander at the collection?
Well, so again, just the first thing was that we didn't even know that we had them. We're not the only museum that has these specimens. They're found around the country. But as we dug further, we came to see that it tells us a little bit about our history and our origin, that a prominent collector down in Alabama thought to send specimens here in the early days of our founding. And we were at one time a major research center in microfungi. I'm in the botany department, which is in the College of Letters and Science. One of our sister departments in the College of Agriculture is plant pathology, and they have kept this tradition alive of studying these parasitic fungi, even though we in the herbarium may not do that any longer.
Talking to Ken Cameron with the Wisconsin State Herbarium, talk about the recent discovery there of fungus samples collected by George Washington Carver. So you're digitizing this collection, a lot of stuff there. Are you expecting to find more surprises of one sort or another?
Yeah, I'm actually a little embarrassed to tell you how we found these specimens in the first place.
Oh, do tell us that.
Well, your listeners will find this amusing. We rely on a very large team of volunteers and students to help us manually database these records. And one of them had entered the word Alaska rather than Alabama for what was abbreviated ALA. And it was actually one of my colleagues in North Carolina who was combing the database online and said, hey, I think you've got something wrong in there. These Tuskegee is in Alabama, not in Alaska. And so I said, oh, thanks for letting me know. And she said, by the way, that's a specimen collected by George Washington Carver. And I said, wait a minute, you mean the African-American scientist? And so it all went from there.
Wow, that must have been an exciting day.
Yeah. So then, of course, we dug into the database and realized I think at this point we've found 28 or 30 of them, and we're going in alphabetical order. We're only up to the H's. So we expect that we're going to find several more.
So any chance you could have other treasures in your collection that you don't know about, or is this just kind of the once-in-a-lifetime fluke?
We always find treasures. I interviewed with you, I think, last year or 2 years ago, where we found a very special specimen that was collected on the battlefield during the Civil War. You may remember that story. So every day is an adventure. Every day is a new discovery. And we are happy that we can bring history back to life through these specimens.
So Wisconsin's home to this huge archive and now a digitized archive. How does that help our understanding, our research of the plants and, in this case, fungal world?
That's a great question. And the best way to answer it is that people who are looking at disease causing organisms today, whether they be viruses like Zika or bacteria or fungi, are very interested in knowing the origin, the source, how the genetics of those pathogenic organisms have changed through time. And these fungi, even though they're over 100 years old, we can actually extract DNA from them and compare the genetics today to what existed in 1900 and see what changes have occurred in the genome. So we've already gotten calls from researchers across campus wanting access to these specimens.
So if I'm a researcher, I've discovered a new blight, and I want to say, where'd this come from? I can compare and contrast with what's on hand there, compare the DNA, see if there's an old strain, a new strain, that
exactly.
sort of thing.
Exactly. It's our closest thing to a time machine. We can't go back and actually collect these things living, but through the preserved form in the herbarium, we can offer up those research materials.
Is there a way for people to come visit? Is there anything for them to see if they do?
We are open to the public, but we're not a museum in the sense that we have exhibits for the public to see. But certainly anyone who would like to make an appointment, come in. I'd be happy to show them the specimens themselves.
Nice. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Ken Cameron, a professor of botany at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and director of the Wisconsin State Herbarium.